We have some here who were present with us during the previous week and some who have come in. I have been dealing with the beginnings of the Reformation in Germany, and since some of you were not here for the previous time, I shall give a brief review and then continue from that point. I began by raising the question as to why churches should ever need to be reformed. Does there appear to be a law of degeneration in history, of diminishing energy, of declining zeal? And I tried to analyze some of the possible reasons as to why it is that a movement should lose its first impulse. One, of course, is the general tendency in individuals for emotions to cool. Another is the discrepancy between the generations, for the second generation seldom has the enthusiasm of the first. But there are even more fundamental causes, and they might be called the failures of success. For example, success in winning converts. If the church expands by hordes instead of by individuals, masses come in without adequate preparation. They bring with them their previous beliefs and their previous mores. And although the church in the course of centuries may succeed in eliminating many of the elements which are really unassimilable, many nevertheless may attach themselves permanently and constitute a genuine corruption. And then there is the success of wealth. The church engages in philanthropic enterprises. People feel that this is an institution which they can trust. They may also feel that if they give their money to the church, they will receive some heavenly reward. They begin to transfer vast estates to the church. And all of that has a debilitating effect for the early energy which went into service becomes diverted when all of that can be delegated by passing over some of the church's wealth. Then there is the corruption of power, because wealth provides power. The church at first made use of that power to take over functions of government when government in the barbarian invasions had collapsed. But the day eventually came when the civil rulers were quite able to take over such functions, but the church was unwilling to relinquish that which she had once and quite beneficently exercised. And then we have instances of the misfire of reforms. For example, the church hoped to break up the dynastic episcopal system, whereby bishops were married and had families and passed on their offices to their sons. This could be broken up by clerical celibacy. But the attempt to enforce that reform ended in clerical concubinage. Again, in the midst of all of the feudal warfare of the Middle Ages, the church attempted to bring this to an end by the peace of God and the truce of God. But what actually happened was that the belligerent tendencies were diverted to a war against the heathen, namely the Crusades, and Christianity was even more militarized. And again, in the High Middle Ages, the church sought to be the directing agency for the whole of society, and in the 13th century, as a matter of fact, the papacy enjoyed greater prestige and greater power than any civil agency in Europe. But that power was exercised only by manipulations, by playing one force off against another, by engaging in all manner of political compromises. The church itself became in the process secularized, and the popes of the Renaissance were scarcely to be distinguished from the despots of the Italian cities. These then are some of the causes which created the situation of the 16th century, where there was an immense amount of popular superstition and the treatment of religion as magic, when clerical concubinage was widespread, when the church was continually interfering in politics. These were some of the abuses which many had sought to correct, and in fact in the late Middle Ages we have a swarming of protesting sects, particularly in southern France and northern Italy, from the 12th century on. They stress the vernacular, they stress the lay element, they oppose the institutionalism of the church. Some of them were pacifist. Then again, there were others which took on a nationalistic tinge, Wycliffe in England, Huss in Bohemia. They were not coordinated, they were not widespread, and the church, at the pinnacle of her power, when the structure began to crack, invoked and instituted the Inquisition to suppress these dissident movements by force, and was sufficiently successful that by the time of the Reformation, they were either exterminated or contained. Hussitism was contained, the moderate Hussites were tolerated in a section of Bohemia, the Waldenses were driven up to the very highest livable areas of the Alps, the Jews were expelled from Spain, the church felt secure, and there was a liberal reform movement in the early years of the century which hoped to transform Europe and the church by a gradual process of education. And then came the dramatic and convulsive reform of Martin Luther. The question then arises as to why, after the failure of so many movements, there should come one with such a far-reaching effects. Some suggest that it was just that things were right. There was a particular concatenation of circumstance. There was a prince who was ready to protect Luther. The papacy was tied up in conflicts with the civil state and did not effectively interfere, and so on. Now, it's true that all of those circumstances were there, but were these primary? One modern author has said that Luther didn't say a thing that was new, and therefore it must have been the circumstances. Another author replies, why, to be sure, he didn't say anything that hadn't been said by somebody sometime. But nevertheless, he pulled things together in such fashion and infused them with such personal dynamic that they took hold. And he was saying something which was certainly new over against the prevailing emphases of his own generation. What he was doing was to reassert the historical character of Christianity as a religion rooted in an act of God in the past. His own age was emphasizing man's genuine independence of something that God had done long ago. For one thing, there was an emphasis on moralism, on what man can do and do here and now, regardless of the past. And if only he does the best he can, it'll all come out all right, and God will treat him genially. And there is mysticism, that man here and now, by turning within, can find the infinite and discover his peace. And institutionalism, that there is a great institution, the church, which is the custodian and the interpreter of the revelation, and can give to man the voice of God in contemporary form. And over against all these, Luther said that something happened 1,500 years earlier of a unique character, and that it is only by appropriating what God has done in the past that man is able to find his peace with the eternal. Well, if Luther was saying something new, and if this newness was to take hold and evoke the enthusiasm of an entire generation, how did Luther arrive at these understandings? Here, the history of the Reformation becomes, for a time, biography, and we are driven to the understanding of Luther's historical development. And there we have had various schools of interpretation. There is one of which I didn't speak last time. I think it's hardly worth mentioning, but I shall just say a word, namely, this was the view advanced by one Roman Catholic opponent in the late 19th century, that Luther was degenerate, that he was simply justifying all of the abuses of the late Middle Ages, sexual abuses. He ran off with a nun and so on. It's the sex drive which is made fundamental for Luther. I'll go into the question of the details of his marriage later on, but suffice it to say that no Roman Catholic advances that kind of approach seriously anymore. That long since has been dropped. It was followed around 1900 by an interpretation of Luther by the Jesuit Grisard, who interpreted him in terms of a psychiatric approach saying that the key to Luther was the desire to get out from under his father and then out from under the Pope to thus achieve his independence. That whole explanation was based on three sayings attributed to the aged Luther some 30 years after the event, sayings never seen by Luther in print, allegedly taken down by students as Luther was talking at the table. Now we know that that source, although it has many sayings which have the ring of Luther, cannot be regarded as an historical foundation to the same degree as the works which left his own pen, because sometimes we have the same saying recorded by three students and the recordings are divergent. And Luther never saw the table talk. To reconstruct his youth on the basis of late reminiscences imperfectly recorded is not to work from a sound historical source. That's one of the weaknesses. And it may be said that in his genuine works in later life, Luther showed very great affection for his parents, particularly for his father. There is another aspect of this explanation which comes to the fore in a book by Erik Erikson entitled Young Luther, and I'll say another word about that. He has all of this anti-papa, anti-mama complex, right enough, and takes that whole line right over from Grisard, though he never mentions him, maybe doesn't even know that's where it came from, because it went through a Danish psychiatrist, Reitsma, and Erikson got it out of Reitsma, I think, and may not have realized that it began as Jesuit polemic. But never mind where it came from. The question is, of course, whether it's valid. But there is another point he makes, and that is that Luther's whole drive is to achieve his identity. Now, that's a technical word, and I confess I'm not quite sure what the psychiatrists mean by it, but as he uses it, it appears to mean the desire to be somebody in one's own right, to have a standing in the community, to have a certain rating with one's contemporaries, to have both respect and influence. It sounds to me as if what it means is that the great drive is not the sex drive, but you might say the power drive. It's what Augustine called the libido dominandi, the lust of power. I feel that that's a fundamental misinterpretation of the whole of human nature. But another thing occurs to me as I've been thinking this over, and I would respectfully suggest this to psychiatrists, that they may interpret human nature in terms of the patients who come to them. One day I was on the train sitting in front of a man behind me who was talking quite earnestly with a young girl. And after the girl got off, I got to chatting with him, and I found that he was a Jewish psychiatrist, and she was a Jewish girl who was ardently working on Hebrew in order that she might become a teacher of Hebrew. He said, "You know, you can't understand how refreshing that conversation has been to me, because as a psychiatrist, I'm working all the time with maladjusted youngsters who haven't any idea where they're going." Now, he said, that girl knows. She's got direction. She loves what she's doing. She's going to master Hebrew. She's going to teach Hebrew. He said it was a joy to talk to a normal girl like that. Well, now, I can understand that if a psychiatrist is working with abnormal youngsters all the time, it might lead to an attempt to interpret all of human nature with reference to such mental maladies. I suggest that respectfully, and I should be ready to be corrected by my psychiatrist friends. But at any rate, I am inclined to call into question Erikson's picture of human nature in general and Luther's in particular. But I would grant this degree of validity to it. It is true that Luther was concerned with a personal problem. He did not start out to reform the church. He started out to solve an individual difficulty. And that difficulty was his whole relationship, not to his immediate environment and his fellows, but to the universe in its totality, or to use religious language, God. He felt alienated with reference to his whole universe, and in particular, concerned about his eternal destiny, what would happen to him after death. But it's not only that. It is the terror of alienation from the God of all the world. The very fright before the holiness, the majesty, and the wrath of God. It is a personal problem. John Calvin didn't have it, by the way. And Calvin talks almost as if he were criticizing Luther. In one passage he says, "What good did any man ever do who was everlastingly worrying about his salvation?" He said, "It isn't right for you to be concerned with what God's going to do with you. Just accept anything he's going to do with you. Bow in submission. Stop worrying. And put forth your utmost effort to do God's will." It's a new form of activism, which comes out of submission. Not trying to earn your salvation, but being willing to be damned, for that matter, for the glory of God. That phrase was used, you know. But Luther was constantly concerned with his relationship. He had his ups and his downs. He didn't get justified by faith, cut and dried for the rest of his life. He was having recurrent spiritual difficulties, and his whole life was a struggle for faith. And that was why he so identified himself with an Abraham sacrificing Isaac, with a Jonah in the belly of the whale, with a Syrophoenician woman daring to argue with Christ and to drive him from his apparent yes to his apparent no to his underlying yes. All of that is Luther's own personal experience. He is wrestling like Jacob with the angel and will not let him go until he is given a blessing. So it's true that there is a personal concern with Luther, not, I would say, megalomania, and not the desire to dominate him, to be somebody. He'd be willing to be utterly crushed if only he felt that he was right with God. He said, "He who has trembled before God has no fear of man." And that was what made him so brave. He had trembled in the face of God. But you still got another problem then. If Luther is constantly endeavoring to come into the clear with regard to his own personal situation, how was it that he sparked a movement all over Germany and all over Europe? Was everybody in that situation and just waiting for him to speak up? Or did they follow him for wrong reasons? Because he criticized the papacy, because he talked like a German against the Italians, or something else of the kind? Was the Reformation really a popular affirmation of Luther's religious insights? Or was it widespread because it didn't understand him? Now, that's something I'm puzzling over. The transmission of individual experience to the masses, of course, is what we call communication. But you might raise the same question about Pope John. Did Pope John speak to a mood that was already in Catholicism and just waiting for somebody to take off the lid? Or did Pope John's attitude toward the Protestants and all the rest of them create a mood in Catholicism with which people identified themselves after he had spoken? I've talked with so many Catholics who have a sense of relief over what Pope John said that it would appear that there must have been an enormous amount of ferment, actually, to which he spoke. And on the other hand, in a great many instances, Catholics have changed their attitude, because of the Pope's pronouncement. So perhaps these two are working together all the time, that an individual may speak to the condition of his generation, which the generation hadn't yet vocalized, and again, he may create in them the attitude that he had. Now, I suggested that Luther's experience comes out of a universal mood, namely the preoccupation with the cult of death,
which had followed the great plague of 1348, when about a third of the population of Europe died off. And after that, we have so many treatises on death and preparation for death and morbid pictures of ghastly corpses and all that kind of thing. And that was widespread. On the other hand, we mustn't exaggerate the widespreadness of it, because the intensity of that particular preoccupation became somewhat muted, because 1348 was the death, Great Black Death, and Luther, 1517. You see, you've got nearly 200 years in between. There's a recent book in Italian on il culto de morte del Medioevo, in the cult of death in the Middle Ages, which points out that people got inured to it after a while and weren't quite so frightened as just after 1348. They became rather indifferent, and the preachers would stoke up hell in order to revive their fear of death. And then if they got too terrified, then purgatory was introduced by way of mitigation. And if that didn't stir them up enough, then the temperature was raised on purgatory. And if that became too hot to be endurable, they introduced indulgences by way of mitigation. And so the preaching played on the fears and the resolutions of the anxieties, so you don't have an entire generation in a state of perpetual anxiety. And then, too, you can overdo this kind of thing. People can't live indefinitely on horror and anxiety. And Huizinga, in his Waning of the Middle Ages, says that there were instances in Burgundy where the people became so inured to all this propaganda on death that they'd actually have a picnic right next to a cemetery where there was a heap of unburied corpses to show their contempt for the whole thing. Eat, drink, and be merry, and so what? In other words, then, one isn't to picture an entire generation as in a state of perpetual torment and anxiety, and it's perfectly obvious that there weren't many, if any, who went through the same kind of a struggle as Luther. Are we then to infer that Luther both created the anxiety and then gave the answer to the anxiety, or that he spoke to an anxiety already there and offered people something they were waiting for? In a way, I suppose, that's what all preaching does. It has to create the need, the sense of need first. People aren't just hungering for the gospel. They have to be persuaded they need it first. And after you get them to the point where they need it, then give them what it has to offer. First, you've got to create the anxiety. Then, to come back to the personal problem, if it is true that man is in the state of alienation from God, why did Luther feel it so acutely and other people didn't? There were multitudes of monks who took it all very easily. They didn't get all wrought up over it. Is it true, as some Catholics have said of Luther, that he was a scrupulant? A scrupulant is one who magnifies difficulties and just can't be satisfied. You give him all kinds of explanations and he comes back with another problem tomorrow. He's a scrupulant. You just can't satisfy him. And what makes a scrupulant? Is there something wrong with his hormones? Or is he more acute in perceiving difficulties that are really there in the religious structure, but other people just don't want to be bothered with facing up to them? Luther takes everything that medieval religion taught and pushes it to its ultimate and comes out saying, this doesn't answer my problem. And that drives him back to the study of Paul and to that experience of liberation by giving up striving, by recognizing that the best he can do will never give him any claim on God, and that he must simply not quit trying to do the best he can, to be sure, but quit trying to get anything that'll give him any claim on God, and relying solely on God's mercy, declared and vouchsafed in Christ. There's a terrific logic about this man. We talk about the irrationality of his religion, and to be sure, it's irrational in a sense. but it's utterly logical in the way in which he takes step by step the contemporary medieval religion and pushes it to a negative, and then jumps back to the Pauline message. Well, you'll see, I haven't got answers to all these questions. And they're not just questions of the 16th century. They are also the questions of how the insight or the revelation given to an individual is transmitted. Does he have first to persuade people that there's a problem and then give them the answer? Does he speak to a yearning that's already there? Probably a mixture of both. And it's quite plain in the case of Luther that there were some people who felt the difficulty and had an enormous feeling of release when they read him. Albrecht Dürer did, the great artist, and Hans Sachs, the Meister singer. He wrote a poem about Luther who spoke of his experience. So there were some, certainly, who had had experiences in a measure comparable to those of Luther and to whose condition he spoke. Well, with this preface now, let us come to the immediate circumstance which sparked the Reformation as a movement and as something more than the struggle for internal adjustment to the universe or the overcoming of alienation with God, whichever vocabulary you prefer, in the case of one man, Martin Luther. What set things off was that Luther became a pastor. If he'd stayed as a professor, why, maybe the world would have been where it was, but he was a pastor as well as a professor, and he had a congregation. And his congregation came in with indulgences, which might release their parents from purgatory or cut down the number of years they'd have to put in and so on. And they presented these things. Luther was perfectly horrified. The immediate circumstance arose out of a scandalous transaction of which at the time Luther was not aware. The whole theory of the thing seemed to him wrong rather than the particular details, but the details certainly are revelatory with regard to the state of the church in his day. It so happened that Albert of Brandenburg of the House of Hohenzollern, which was the great house opposed to the House of Habsburg, sought to enhance the power of his own house by the acquiring of another ecclesiastical dignity. He wasn't old enough to be a bishop anywhere, but he was already a bishop in Halberstadt and Magdeburg, and now he wanted to be the Archbishop of Mainz. If he were, that would make him the Primate of Germany, an elector of the Holy Roman Emperor, and would give such power to the House of Hohenzollern that it would give it a standing over against the House of Habsburg. Politics entered into this. But for such irregularities, one had to get a dispensation from the Pope and pay for it. Holding more than one bishopric was called pluralism and was generally recognized as an abuse and nevertheless was very widely practiced. One bishop who had half a dozen sees was asked why he held so many. He said, well, if I hold all of these, why, it'll mean that only one man will get damned for it. So he was conferring a benefit upon his brethren. Pluralism was irregular. Albert knew that he'd have to pay a considerable sum. He knew, of course, that you'd have to give all of the first year's income to the Pope. That was a regular procedure when one was appointed to a bishopric. This was called the system of annates. The papacy collected the first year's income. But the incumbent commonly paid this in advance and borrowed the money, and then afterwards paid it off at interest. The church theoretically disapproved of interest, but paid it nevertheless. Well, Albert started negotiations with the Pope, and the Pope asked him 12,000 ducats for the 12 apostles. He said he wasn't paying for the apostles. He was paying for his sins, and there are seven deadly sins, so he'd give 7,000 ducats. They compromised on 10,000. In my life of Luther, I threw in parenthetically, presumably not for the Ten Commandments. This became history in the Luther movie, because there the Pope says, all right, let's split the difference for the Ten Commandments. It becomes a saying of the Pope instead of a little facetiousness on the part of a biographer. And from the movie, it went into a sober history of the Reformation. A reviewer of that history said, where on earth did he get that? Well, I could tell him. Which I suppose indicates that biographers ought to be sober. Well, I'm sorry if I've created a legend. The Pope did not suggest splitting the difference for the Ten Commandments. But anyhow, they did make it ten. Well, Albert, of course, borrowed that money right away from the House of Fugger, the great banking house in Germany. Paid it down. The papacy already had the 10,000 ducats. In order, however, to reimburse Albert, the Pope gave him the permission of declaring an indulgence within the territories over which he had jurisdiction for a period of 8 years, if I recall. If I've slipped on the number, it won't matter too much, because all the good the indulgence has done did was have been worn off by now. But anyhow, it was a fair period of time. This money, which would be in the future collected, would go half of it to Albert to reimburse him for what he'd already paid, and the other half to the Pope in order to build the Basilica of St. Peter's. The old church built by Constantine had become unsafe. It was simply riddled with wormholes, and they'd had to tear it down. In the papacy of Julius II, that pope had constructed the piers, and then money had lagged, and the piers were just growing grass. But now Leo revived the project and was endeavoring to raise money for the completion of the edifice. Matter of fact, they didn't get it done until the 1560s. Michelangelo drew the final plans, which were a modification of the earlier ones. Bramante drew it up at first, and they had to cut it down. It wasn't done until the 1560s. So this was to raise money for the building of the present Basilica of St. Peter's. Albert of Brandenburg put out instructions to those who should dispense the indulgences. Now a word about the history of indulgences. They go back to the Crusades. There were those who were unable to go to the Holy Land, but who might make a contribution to the enterprise. The Pope granted to them a remission of certain ecclesiastical penalties. For example, if he had required that a man, as satisfaction for a certain sin, should make a visit to St. James of Compostela, instead he might make a contribution for the Crusade. Or, again, for some other ecclesiastical penalty which would be remitted. A penalty imposed by the Pope on earth is remitted by the Pope in return for some money contribution. It goes back to the old Germanic law of monetary compensation in the case of many offenses. But as the Crusades waned, the concept was extended to apply to any worthy enterprise, such as the building of a church or a hospital or a bridge. The great Gothic cathedrals were built out of the proceeds of indulgences. This way of raising money commended itself very highly to the church, because it did not create resentment, since it was voluntary. You didn't have to get an indulgence. You did have to pay your tithes, and if you didn't pay your tithes, you might lose your cow. But the indulgence was voluntary. Consequently, it was very widely encouraged. Now, there was a theological theory laying behind it, namely, that the saints were better than they needed to be to bring about their own salvation. A little before Pope John, I saw a pamphlet put out by, I think, the Paulus Fathers. I saw it in a Catholic church, which defended the doctrine even in our own day. It said, you would admit that you can do some that a man can do some good work which, if he hadn't done, he wouldn't have been damned. So that particular good work wasn't necessary for his salvation. That being the case, it's an extra. So you can do more than is necessary for your own salvation. The saints did. They ended with their accounts in the black. Now, these merits are stored up in a celestial banking house called the Thesaurus Meritorum Sanctorum, the treasury of the merits of the saints. The Pope has the key to this banking house, and he is able to make a transfer of these unused credits to the benefit of those whose accounts are in arrears. All of this is set forth in the bull of Celestine the Fifth, or have I forgotten his number? But anyway, it goes back about to the 13th century, and the theory, definitely, the Thesaurus Meritorum Sanctorum, is very plainly set forth in that bull. Sometimes people will write in and say, now, just what on earth is the authority for all of these statements? To which I will reply that, unfortunately, we don't have it in English, but we do have all of the documents on the whole history of indulgences collected by Walter Köhler in Dokumente zum Ablassstreit, documents on the indulgence controversy. And they're all given, they're practically all in Latin, but there's your evidence on the growth of the theory of indulgences. And that bull is definitely there. Then an extension was made from penalties imposed by the Pope on earth to penalties imposed by God in purgatory. But this had been done only by Sixtus the Fourth, and only about some 70 years before Luther. The claim was not actually made that release from purgatory would follow. The claim was only that the length of time in purgatory would be reduced. And how long that would be, nobody exactly knew. But indulgences were piled up until one might be able to cut it down by 1,000,000 years. But of course, if you'd sinned 2 or 3 million's worth, why, you'd still have a while to put in. You didn't know exactly. Then the claim began to be advanced that the release would be immediate. Of course, you had to be dead first. You couldn't get yourself released before you were there, but you could use this for the benefit of your parents. When Luther went to Rome, he was sorry his parents weren't down there already, so he could use up these special Roman privileges for them. This applied to the dead in purgatory. In the case of the living, however, it would cut down the amount of time to be spent in purgatory, such as the teaching. Now, strictly, the indulgences applied only to the penalties for sin and not to sin itself. But there were a few indulgences which granted remission of sins as well as of penalties. The formula was pina et culpa, from the pain, from the penalty, and from the blame. From penalty and guilt, these indulgences are granted. The instructions of Albert of Brandenburg were the most extensive in their pretensions of any ever issued in the Middle Ages, because he said that they would grant remission of sins, remissionem omnium peccatorum, remission of all sins, that they would give preferential treatment to those who sinned in the future. It didn't actually give permission to sin, but still it said if you did in the future, you'd get off a bit better if you had the indulgence. It was preferential treatment. And that those who took out indulgences on behalf of their dead relatives need not themselves be contrite for their own sins. Now, those three points are new in the instructions of Albert of Brandenburg, and they go beyond anything previously. Well, Leo X had issued one that gave the remission of sins, but preferential treatment in the future, and not having to be contrite for your own sins, those go farther than anything before. Now, it was this document against which Luther protested in the 95 Theses. And it was because, although the indulgence applied only to the territories of Albert, and Luther's Saxony was not a part of the territory of Albert, nevertheless, The frontier was close, and some of his parishioners were going over the line and getting these indulgences and then coming back to Wittenberg, and that was what set him off. One ought also to bear in mind that Frederick the Wise annually had a big indulgence fair, and Luther had protested against that the previous year, and yet that didn't take on. But when, in 1517, he posted his theses asking for debate on a whole series of propositions, and when it applied to the man who had just been made the primate of Germany, that did set off the great controversy. The indulgences have 95 paragraphs. They haven't got 95 points. Some of it centered on the ostensible purpose of the indulgence, because the instructions of Albert did say, and this is all he mentioned, that the purpose was to build the Church of St. Peter's, to provide a roof for the bones of the apostles Peter and Paul, which are now moldering in all weather. He got to have a good house for the bones of the apostles, is the point which he makes. To which Luther replies that if the Pope knew the poverty of the German people, he would rather that St. Peter's lay in ashes than that it should be built out of the blood and hide of his sheep. Here was the German note. Why build a mausoleum for all Christendom in Rome when local parishes can't raise enough money to repair the roofs of their local churches? This is localism versus universalism. It's the German feeling against the Italian. Frequently you find in Luther the note that the Pope is treating Germany as his Milchkuh, his milk cow. He's squeezing all the milk out of the German cow. Now, the Germans have been protesting against many of the papal exactions for the last 100 years. The Gravamine der Deutschen Nation, the complaints of the German nations at all of the diets of the empire, have been repeated over and over again. At this point, there's nothing original, and Luther is voicing local feeling. But next, he comes to a theological point. The Pope has no jurisdiction over purgatory, and if he does, he ought to empty the place gratis. This was said in immediate reply to the vendor of the indulgences, Tetzel, who went so far as to offer immediate release. As soon as the money clinks in the chest, the souls will jump into heavenly rest, was his little jingle. But the Pope has no jurisdiction at all. Now, there are many theologians who would agree with that. But finally, Luther attacks the whole theory. There is no such thing as a thesaurus meritorum sanctorum, a treasury of the merits of the saints. The only treasury of the church is the gospel. And the gospel shatters all confidence and should. They are damned who flee damnation. That is to say, those who try to manipulate God to buy it off. Those who are genuinely penitent would rather welcome penalty than to try to bargain with God and indulge in bookkeeping with the eternal. This is not an exact translation, that's the point of it. And that is the most fundamental radicalism in the 95 Theses. Now, a modern author has lately said that the 95 Theses are an epitome of Catholic theology and not heresy at all. Well, that raises the question of what is heresy? Erasmus said that Luther was not a heretic, and he said he couldn't see anything wrong with the Theses unless perhaps he was a little too sharp on purgatory. But the Pope appointed the master of the Sacred Palace to reply to Luther, and he called it heresy. And the Pope said it was heresy. And Cardinal Cajetan said it was heresy. What makes heresy? Erasmus said, heresy is the other fellow's opinion. Now, it's quite true that you could find statements which would support what Luther had said up and down the line in the writings of people who had not been condemned by the church. perhaps the word heresy becomes meaningless. But certainly this is plain, that the leaders of the church in Luther's day said it was heresy, and he was eventually condemned for heresy. There is, however, enough ambiguity in the term heresy so that the church today could very well rescind the excommunication of Luther. Hans Küng of Tübingen, the Catholic theologian, is urging that the church should rescind Luther's excommunication. They could do it without taking back any of their presuppositions perfectly well. And as for the claim that nobody has any merits or can do any bargaining with God, there are statements of that character up and down the line in the previous history of Christianity. And there's an interesting story about a woman who enacted a fable. She walked down the street with a brazier of burning coals in one hand. The brazier, of course, is not hot on the bottom. And a pail of water in the other. And she was asked what she was doing. She said, "I am carrying the water to put out the fires of hell, and I am carrying the brazier to burn up the delights of paradise, that men may love God for his own sake, and not either for fear of penalty or hope of reward." Now that's the kind of thing that Luther could say, and that's the essence of his criticism of the whole indulgence affair. It's an attempt to manipulate God by bargaining with man's virtues. Well, now, as I say, Albert forwarded the theses to Rome. The Pope appointed one of his officials to make a reply. He branded Luther as a heretic. Luther replied hotly with resolutions in the defense of the indulgences. His writings began to enjoy a widespread popularity. The Pope summoned him to Rome. When Luther's prince, founder of the University of Wittenberg, and incidentally, the whole faculty supported Luther, and that was a very important factor. Frederick had great respect for his faculty. Frederick the Wise, Luther says, unsolicited, stepped in. Unsolicited by Luther, anyhow. But Erasmus had written him a letter and told him he ought to see to it that Luther was not condemned without a fair trial. He stepped in to insist that Luther should have a hearing on German soil. He didn't trust the Italians. And the Pope yielded the point and agreed that Luther could be heard at a diet that was meeting at Augsburg in 1518, where Cardinal Cajetan would be in attendance. Now, Cardinal Cajetan was one of the most high-minded ecclesiastics of the age. Here is the confrontation of Luther, not with one of the loose-living, flippant popes of the Renaissance, like Leo X, who is said to have said, "The papacy is ours, let us enjoy it." Not Cajetan. He was learned, he was high-minded, he was devout. It's the best of Catholicism confronting Luther here. Cajetan had an interview with Luther in which he presented him with that papal bull which asserted the doctrine of the merits of the saints and the treasury. And Luther, first of all, tried to reinterpret the document so it wouldn't mean what it seemed to say. But Cajetan was too acute for that. He drove him and drove him and drove him until Luther had to admit that it said what it looked as if it said, and then he said, "It's wrong." So he had pushed him to the point where he denied the validity of a papal bull, which also had been incorporated into the canon law. So this was a little more than to say that a pope had made a mistake. The canon law itself was in error. Thereupon Cajetan said to him, "Go and do not return unless you are willing to say revoco." I revoke. I recant. Luther was smuggled out of town. He returned home, but he fully expected that he would have to go into exile. They said to him, "Where will you go?" "Unter den freien Himmel." Out in the open somewhere. He said goodbye to his congregation. He would have been gone in 2 hours if word had not come from the chaplain of the elector saying, "The elector prefers that you remain." What had happened? There are some intimations that Frederick had wavered at first, and one reported to Luther, "The elector would feel better if you were gone." Possibly he did waver, and then came into the clear and decided that he would stand back of him. There's so many cases in history where we can't clear up certain points. We don't know what went on. We do know, we'll have the fact that a man seems to be willing to let down, and then 2 or 3 days later we find that he's taking a firm stand. What went on in between? Well, that we don't know. But anyhow, Frederick told him to remain. We do know that an external factor had entered into it, namely, the emperor was dying, Maximilian. An election would very shortly be up. The Holy Roman Emperor had a loose authority over Germany and Austria. He wasn't a monarch like the heads of the national states. The Holy Roman Empire was losing its medieval universal authority, but still it was more than a shadow. The office was elective. The possible candidates were Francis of France, Charles of Spain, and Henry of England. The Pope didn't want any of them. Anyone, if he got control over Germany, would be too powerful. He thought it would be better to have a little prince who wouldn't have enough authority on his own to swing sufficient power to undo the balance in Europe. And the prince who was the Pope's preference was the senior elector in the College of the Electors of the Holy Roman Empire, and as it happened, it was Frederick the Wise, Luther's own prince. So the Pope was willing to let up for a bit on Martin Luther until they got the election settled. And I think we'll have to leave it unsettled until Wednesday.